From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. The Israeli airstrike that killed 7 aid workers delivering food in Gaza has touched off outrage and condemnations from across the world. Today, Kim Severson on the pioneering relief crew at the center of the story, and Adam Raskin on what we're learning about the deadly attack on the group's workers. It's Thursday, April 4th. Kim, can you tell us about the World Central Kitchen?
World Central Kitchen started as a little idea in Chef Jose Andre's head. He was in Haiti with some other folks trying to do earthquake relief in 2010. And his idea at that point was to teach Haitians to cook and to use solar stoves and ways for people to feed themselves because the infrastructure was gone. And he was cooking with some Haitians in one of the camps, and they were showing him how to cook beans the Haitian way. You sort of smash them and make them a little creamy. And it occurred to him that there was something so comforting for those folks to eat food that was from their culture, that tasted good to them. You know, if you're having a really hard time, what makes you feel good is comfort food, right? And warm comfort food.
Right.
So that moment in the camp really was the seed of this idea. It planted this notion in Jose Andres' mind. And that notion eventually became World Central Kitchen.
And for those who don't know, Kim, who exactly is Chef Jose Andres?
Jose Andres is a Spanish chef who cooked under some of the Spanish molecular gastronomy greats, came to America, really made his bones in Washington, D.C., with some avant-garde food, but also started to expand and cook tapas, cook Mexican food. He's got about 40 restaurants now.
Wow.
Yeah, and, you know, he's got a great Spanish restaurant in New York. He's got restaurants in D.C., restaurants in Miami.
Come with me to the kitchen. Don't be shy.
He's also become a big TV personality.
Chef, are you going to put the lobster in the pot with the potatoes?
We're going to leave the potatoes
in. Leave the potatoes in.
He's one of the most charismatic people I've ever been around in the food world.
Mm-hmm.
He's very much the touchstone of what people want their celebrity chefs to be.
So how does he go from being all those things you just described to being on the ground, making local comfort food for Haitians? And how does this all go from an idea that that would be a good idea to this much bigger, full-fledged humanitarian organization?
So he started to realize that giving people food in disaster zones was a thing that was really powerful. He helped feed people after Hurricane Sandy, and he realized that he could get local chefs who all wanted to help and somehow harness that power. But the idea really became set when he went to Houston in 2017 to help after Hurricane Harvey. And that's when he saw that getting local chefs to tap into their resources, borrowing kitchens, using ingredients that chefs might have had on hand or, you know, are spoiling in the fridge because the power's out and all these restaurants needed something to do with all this food before it rotted, harnessing all that and putting it together and giving people well-cooked, delicious, at least as delicious as it can be in a disaster zone. That's when World Central Kitchen, as we know it today, sort of emerged as a fully formed concept.
The first pictures now coming in from Puerto Rico after taking a direct hit. Hurricane Maria slamming into the island, and as you heard, one official saying the island is destroyed.
Shortly after that, he flew to Puerto Rico, where Hurricane Maria had pretty much left the entire island without water and in darkness.
Right.
He flew in on one of the first commercial jets that went back in. He got a couple of his chef buddies whose kitchens were closed, and they just decided to start cooking. They were basically just serving pots of stew, chicken stew, in front of the restaurants. The lines got longer. And of course, chefs are a really specific kind of creature. They really like to help their community. They're really about feeding people. So all the people who were chefs or cooks on the ground in Puerto Rico who could wanted to help. And you had all these chefs in the States who wanted to fly down and help if they could too. So you had this constant flow of chefs coming in and out. That's when I went down and followed him around for about a week.
And what did you see?
Well, one of the most striking things was his ability to get food to remote places in ways the Salvation Army couldn't and other government agencies that were on the ground couldn't. You know, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, doesn't deliver food. It contracts with people to deliver food. So you have all these steps of bureaucracy you have to go through to get those contracts. And then FEMA says you have to have a bottle of water and this and that in those boxes. There's a lot of structure to be able to meet the rules and regulations of FEMA. So Jose doesn't really care about rules and regulations very much. So he just got his troops together and figured out where people needed food. He had this big paper map he'd carry around and lay out and had a Sharpie, and he'd circle villages where he'd heard people needed food or where a bridge was out. And then he would dispatch people to get the food there. Now, how are you going to do that? He was staying in a hotel where some National Guard and military police were staying to go patrol areas to make sure they were safe. He would tuck his big aluminum pans of food into the back of those guys' cars and say, could you stop and drop these off at this church?
Mm-hmm.
During that time in Puerto Rico, he funded a lot of it off of his own credit cards or with cash. And then he's on the phone with people like the president of Goya or his golf buddies who are well-connected saying, hey, we need some money. Can you send some money for this? Can you send some money for that? So he just developed this network almost overnight. I mean, he is very much a general in the field. You know, he wears this Orvis fishing vest, has cigars in one pocket, money in the other, and he just sets out to feed people. And there were deliveries that were as simple as he and a couple of folks taking plastic bags with food and wading through a flooded parking lot to an apartment building where an older person had been stuck for a few days and couldn't get out, to driving up to a community that had been cut off. There was a church that was trying to distribute food. We drive through this little mountain road and get to this church. We start unloading the food, and the congregation is inside the church. Jose comes in, and the pastor thanks him so much. And the 20 people or so who were there gather around Jose, and they begin praying. And he puts his head down. He's a Catholic. He's a man who prays. He puts his head down. He's in the middle of these folks, and he starts to pray with them. And then pulls out his map, circles another spot, and the group is off to the next place. And when Russia invades Ukraine, he immediately decided it was time for World Central Kitchen to step into a war zone. You know, so many people needed to eat. So many Ukrainians were crossing the border into Poland. There are refugees in several countries surrounding Ukraine. So a lot of the work that they did was feeding the refugees. They set up big operations around train stations, places where refugees were coming. And then they were able to get into cities. One of their operations did get hit with some armaments early on. Nobody was hurt badly, but I think that was the first time that they realized this was an actually more dangerous situation than perhaps going in after there's been an earthquake. But the other thing that really made a difference here is Jose Andres and World Central Kitchen would broadcast on social media live from the kitchens. In the beginning, he'd be holding up his phone and saying, we put out 3 million meals for the people of Puerto Rico, chefs for Puerto Rico. It was very infectious. And now one of the standard operating procedures for people who are in the World Central Kitchens is to hold up the phone like that. You can see the kitchen busy in the back and talk about how many meals they've served. You know, they have these kind of wild meal counts, which one presumes are pretty accurate, but they're like, we served 320,000 meals this morning to the people of Lviv.
I mean, that scale seems important to know. This is not the kind of work that feeds, you know, a few people in a few towns. When you're talking about 300,000 meals in a morning, you're talking about something that begins, it would seem, to rival the scope and the reach of the groups that we tend to think of as the most important in the disaster relief world.
Absolutely. And the meals, there are lots and lots and lots of meals, but also World Central Kitchen hires local cooks. They'll hire food truck operators who obviously have no work and pay them to go out and deliver the meals. They'll pay local cooks to come in and cook. That's what they do with a lot of their donations, which is very different than other aid organizations. And this then helps the local economy. He's trying to buy as much local food as he can. That keeps the economy going in the time of a disaster. So that's a piece of his operation that is a little different than traditional aid operations.
So walk us up to October 7th when Hamas attacked Israel. What does Chef Jose Andres and the World Kitchen do?
Well, he had had such impact in Ukraine, and I think the organization itself thought that they had the infrastructure to now take food into another war zone. Gaza, of course, was nothing like Ukraine. But World Central Kitchen shows up. They're nimble. They start to connect with local chefs. Right now, they have about 60 kitchens in the areas around Gaza, and they've hired about 400 Palestinians to help do that. But getting the food into Gaza, it became the difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
How do you actually get the food into the Gaza Strip? Large amounts of food that require trucks. You've got to realize getting food into Gaza right now requires going through Israeli checkpoints.
Right.
And that slows the operation down. You might get 8 trucks a day in, and that is such a small amount of food. And this has been incredibly difficult for any aid operations.
Mm-hmm.
So World Central Kitchen, playing on the experience that they had in a war zone and working with government entities and trying to coordinate permissions, they took that experience from Ukraine and were trying to apply it in the Gaza Strip. Now, they had worked for a long time with Israeli officials. They wanted to make sure that they could get their food in. And they decided that the best way to do it would be to take food off of ships, get it in a warehouse, and then get that food into Gaza. It took a long time to pull those permissions through, but they were able to get the permissions they needed and set this system up so they could move the food fairly quickly into North Gaza.
And once they get those permissions, how big a player do they become in Gaza?
World Central Kitchen became a kind of a fulcrum point for getting food aid in to Gaza in a way that a larger and more established humanitarian aid operations couldn't, in part because they were small and nimble in their way. So the amount of food they were moving maybe wasn't, you know, as large as some of the more established humanitarian aid organizations. But they had so much goodwill. They had so much logistical knowledge. They were working with local Palestinians who knew the food systems and who understood how to get things in and out. So they were able to find a way to use a humanitarian corridor to have permissions from the Israeli government to be able to move this food back and forth. And that's always been the secret to World Central Kitchen, is incredibly nimble. So
just like in Puerto Rico, they seem to win over just about everybody and do the seemingly impossible.
Right. And World Central Kitchen says they delivered 43 million meals to Gazans since the start of the war. And I don't think there was any other group that could have pulled this off.
Hey, this is Zomi and Chef Olivier. We're at the Dinner by Love Kitchen, and we've got the mise en place. Tell us a little bit about it, Chef Ollie.
And then this caravan, this fairly efficient caravan of armored vehicles labeled with World Central Kitchen logo on the roof, on the sides. The idea was they head on this humanitarian corridor, they head on this road. The 7 people who went all in vests, 3 of whom are security people from Great Britain. You have another World Central Kitchen employee who has handled operations in Asia, in Central America. She's quite a veteran of the World Central Kitchen operation. Mm-hmm. And you have a young man who someone told me was like the Michael Jordan of humanitarian aid, who hooked up with World Central Kitchen in Poland. He was a hospitality student and had just become an indispensable make it happen guy.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a Palestinian guy, he's 25, a driver. So this is the team. They have all the clearances. They have the well-marked vehicles. It seemed like a very simple, surgical kind of operation. And of course, now as we know, it was anything but that.
after the break, my colleague, Adam Razgon, on what happened to the World Central Kitchen workers in that caravan. We'll be right back. So, Adam, what ends up happening to this convoy that our colleague Kim Severson just described from World Central Kitchen?
So what we know is that members of the World Central Kitchen had been at a warehouse in Deir el-Balah in the central Gaza Strip. They had just unloaded about 100 tons of food aid that had been brought via a maritime route to the coast of the Gaza Strip. When they departed the warehouse, they were in three cars. Two of the cars were armored cars, and one was a soft skin car, according to the organization. When the cars reached the coastal road known as El Rashid Street, they started to make their way south.
And what do we know about how much the World Central Kitchen would have told the Israeli military about their plans to be on this road?
Yeah, so the World Central Kitchen said that its movements were coordinated. And in military speak or in technical speak, people often refer to this as deconfliction.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, this process is something that not only the World Central Kitchen, but the UN, telecommunications companies going out to repair, you know, damaged telecommunications infrastructure, others would use, where they basically provide the Israeli military with information about the people who are traveling, their ID numbers, their names, the license plate numbers of the cars they'll be traveling in. They'll sort of explain, you know, where their destination is. And the general process is that the Israelis will then come back to them and say, you're approved to travel from this time and you can take this specific route.
And do we know if that happened? If the IDF said, you're approved, use this route on this night?
So we heard from the World Central Kitchen that they did receive this approval. The military hasn't come out and said that it wasn't approved. So I think it's fair to assume that their movements were coordinated and deconflicted.
Okay, so what happens as this seemingly pre-approved and coordinated convoy trip is making this leg of the journey?
They started to make their way south towards Rafah. And the three cars suddenly came under fire. The Israeli army unleashes powerful and devastating strikes on the three cars in the convoy, most likely from a drone. The strikes rip through the cars, killing everyone inside. Shortly thereafter, ambulances from the Palestine Red Crescent are dispatched to the location. They retrieve the dead bodies. They bring those bodies to a hospital, and at the hospital, the bodies are laid out, and journalists start to report to the world that indeed five members of the World Central Kitchen staff have been killed. And the Palestine Red Crescent teams were continuing the search for other bodies and eventually brought back two more bodies to the hospital for a total of seven people killed in these airstrikes.
And when the sun comes up, what does it end up looking like, the scene of these struck trucks from this convoy?
So early in the morning when the sun comes up, a number of Palestinian journalists headed out to the coastal road and started taking pictures and videos. And I received a series of videos from one of the reporters that I was in touch with, essentially showing three cars, all heavily damaged. One had a World Central Kitchen logo on top of it with a gaping hole in the middle of the roof. A second car was completely charred. You could barely recognize the structure of the car. The inside of it had been completely charred and the front smashed.
And do we know if the strike on this convoy was the only strike happening in this area? In other words, is it possible this convoy was caught in some kind of a crossfire or in the middle of a firefight, or does it appear that this was quite narrow? And was the Israeli army targeting these specific vehicles, whether or not they realized who was in it?
We don't have any other indication that there was another strike on that road around that time.
What that suggests, of course, is that this convoy was targeted. Now, whether Israeli officials knew who was in it, whether they were aid workers, seems like a yet unresolved question. But it does feel very clear that the trucks in this convoy were deliberately struck.
Yes, I do think the trucks in this convoy were deliberately struck.
What is the reaction to these airstrikes on this convoy and to the death of these aid workers?
Well, one of the first reactions is from the World Central Kitchen's founder, Jose Andreas.
Chef Jose Andreas, who founded World Central Kitchen, calling them angels.
He said he was heartbroken and grieving.
And adding, the Israeli government needs to stop this indiscriminate killing.
And then he accused Israel of using food as a weapon.
What I know is that we were targeted deliberately, nonstop, until everybody was dead in this convoy.
And he just seemed devastated and quite angry.
And so what is the reaction from not just World Central Kitchen, but from the rest of the world to this airstrike?
There's frankly fury and outrage.
The White House says it is outraged by an Israeli airstrike that killed seven aid workers in Gaza, including one American.
President Biden, who has been becoming increasingly critical of Israel's approach to this war, he came out and said that he was outraged and heartbroken.
Certainly sharper in tone than we have heard in the past. He says Israel has not done enough to protect aid workers trying to deliver desperately needed help to civilians. Incidents like yesterday's simply should not happen. Israel also has not.
And we're seeing similar outrage from foreign governments. The British Foreign Secretary, David Cameron.
The dreadful events of the last 2 days are a moment when we should mourn the loss of these brave humanitarian workers, including...
said that the airstrikes were completely unacceptable. And he called on Israel to explain how this happened and to make changes to ensure that aid workers could be safe.
So amid all this, what does Israel have to say about the attack, about how it happened, about why it happened?
The response from Israel this time was much different compared to other controversial airstrikes on the Gaza Strip. Often when we're reporting on these issues, we'll hear from the army that they're investigating a given incident. It will take days, if not weeks, to receive updates on where that investigation stands. There are instances where Israel does take responsibility for harming civilians, but it's often rare. This time, the prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, comes out with a video message saying that Israel had unintentionally harmed innocent civilians. And that was the first indication or public indication that Israel was going to take responsibility for what had happened.
The IDF works together closely with the World Central Kitchen and greatly appreciates the important work that they do.
We later heard from the military's chief of staff. Herzi Alevi issued a video statement in English.
I want to be very clear. The strike was not carried out with the intention of harming WCK aid workers. It was a mistake that followed a misidentification.
And he said this mistake had come after a misidentification. He said it was in the middle of a war, in a very complex condition, but...
This incident was a grave mistake. We are sorry for the unintentional harm to the members of WCK.
He was clear that this shouldn't have happened.
I want to talk about that statement because it seems to suggest that word, misidentification, that the Israeli army believed that somebody else was in this convoy, that it wasn't a bunch of aid workers.
That's possible, although it's extremely vague and cryptic language that genuinely is difficult to understand. And it's a question that us in the Jerusalem Bureau have been asking ourselves.
I'm curious if the Israeli government has said anything in all of its statements so far about whether it noticed these markings on these three cars in the convoy, because that, I think, for so many people stands out as making misidentification hard to understand. It seems like perhaps a random pickup truck could be misidentified as perhaps a vehicle being used by a Hamas militant. But a group of World Central Kitchen trucks with their name all over it, driving down a known aid corridor, that becomes harder to understand as misidentification.
Yeah, it's an important question. And at this moment, we don't know exactly what the Israeli reconnaissance drones could see and whether or not they were able to see in the darkness of the night the markings of the World Central Kitchen on the cars. But what is clear is that when the cars were found in the morning, right there was the big emblazoned logo of the World Central Kitchen.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious how you think about the speed with which Israel came out and said it was in the wrong here. Because as you said, that's not how Israel typically reacts to many of these situations. And that makes me think that it might have something to do with the nature of the aid group that was the target of these airstrikes, the World Central Kitchen, and its story.
I think it does have to do with this particular group. This is a group that's led by a celebrity chef, very high profile, who has gone around the world to conflict zones, disaster areas, to provide food aid. And I also think it has to do with the people who were killed, most of who were Western foreign aid workers.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, I don't think we would be having this conversation if a group of Palestinian aid workers had been killed.
Mm-hmm. Nor perhaps would you be having the reaction that we have had so far from the Israeli government.
I would agree with that.
Adam, at the end of the day, what is going to be the fallout from all of this for the people of Gaza? How do we think that this attack on World Central Kitchen is going to impact how food, medicine, aid is distributed there?
So the World Central Kitchen has said that it's suspending its operations across Gaza because it essentially seems that they don't feel they can safely operate there right now. And several ships that carried aid for the organization, which were sort of just on the coast, those ships ended up turning back to Cyprus, carrying more than 200 tons of aid.
So aid that was supposed to reach the people of Gaza is now leaving Gaza because of this attack.
Yes. And it's also had a chilling effect. Another aid group named ANARA has also suspended its operations in Gaza. And it seems that there is concern among humanitarians that other aid groups could follow.
Mm-hmm.
So, in a place where people are already suffering from severe hunger, poor sanitation, the spread of dangerous disease, this is only going to make the humanitarian situation, which is already dire, even worse.
Well, Adam, thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
We'll be right back. Here's what else you need to know today. The magnitude 7.4 earthquake that struck Taiwan on Wednesday has killed 9 people, injured more than 1,000, and touched off several landslides. It was Taiwan's strongest quake in the past 25 years, but in a blessing for the island's biggest cities, its epicenter was off the island's east coast, relatively far from population centers like Taipei. And the first patient to receive a kidney transplanted from a genetically modified pig has fared so well that he was discharged from a Massachusetts hospital on Wednesday, just 2 weeks after surgery. two previous transplants from genetically modified pigs both failed. Doctors say the success of the latest surgery represents a major moment in medicine that, if replicated, could usher in a new era of organ transplantation. Today's episode was produced by Lindsay Garrison, Olivia Natt, and Carlos Prieto, with help from Astha Chaturvedi. It was edited by Mark George, with help from Paige Cowan. Contains original music by Marion Lozano and Dan Powell, and was engineered by Chris Wood. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.